Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the limit and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you for that disclaimer. We appreciate you. Ladies and gentlemen, it's official. We have, and I said so much as much last week, we have a new information provider, and the service that this new information provider offers is a tool that PJ and others may use in assisting you. The preamble that I'm going to give to PJ's talk tonight is picking up where we left off last week. We've talked about we've talked so far about five different separate weeks now. First, it was that you were born a first-class citizen. You were born a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states with all of your rights and liberties emanating from the Almighty One. Most people call God. The second thing is we gave you a 30,000-foot view of everything that was going on is regarding the law found south of Canada and north of Mexico. Then the third week we spoke about how Congress converts state citizens within the freely associated compact states into federal citizens. The fourth week, we talked about the origin of federal citizens, how they came into existence to begin with. And then last week, we talked about how the state citizens are then converted into federal citizens. Tonight, we're going to talk about common law versus commercial law. So, next week, we'll talk about the more federal glue that adheres us to all this nonsense. Besides the municipal laws for federal territory like the District of Columbia, the Constitution specifies three other types of law: common law, equity law, and admiralty law. Common law is, in a sense, criminal law. Equity law deals with written contracts and is basically civil law. Admiralty law deals with international contracts and has both criminal and civil penalties within it. A cursory review of the Uniform Commercial Code proves that it was codified to replace the negotiable instrument laws. Further research reveals that the negotiable instrument laws have their foundation in the jurisdiction of admiralty law, which is otherwise known as maritime law or the law of the sea. The Uniform Commercial Code has come to be known in law as the substantion or substantive common law. Reference to that is the court case Bank versus Moore, 201 Alabama, 411, 78 South, 789. This substantive common law has also been directly tied to the jurisdiction of the law merchant, which is international law. And this is a decision from Miller versus Miller, 296 Southwest 2nd Edition, 648. Under the common law, every contract must be entered into knowingly, voluntarily, intentionally, by both parties, or it's void and unenforceable. Common law contracts must also be based on substance. For example, contracts used to be read as for $1 and other valuable considerations, I'll paint your house. That was a valid contract. The dollar was genuine silver dollar. Now, suppose you wrote a contract that said for one Federal Reserve note and other valuable considerations. Suppose, for example, I painted your house the wrong color. Could you go into a common law court and get justice? No, you cannot. You see, a Federal Reserve note is a colorable dollar, as it has no substance. And in common law jurisdiction, the contract would be simply unenforceable. The word colorable means something that appears to be genuine, but is not. If it looks like a dollar and spends like a dollar, but it's not redeemable for lawful money, i.e. silver or gold, it's colorable. If a Federal Reserve note is used in a contract, and then the contract becomes a colorable contract. And a colorable contract, they must be enforced under colorable jurisdictions. So by creating Federal Reserve notes, the government had to create a jurisdiction to cover the kinds of contracts that use them. We now have what is called statutory jurisdiction, which is not a genuine admiralty jurisdiction. It is a colorable admiralty jurisdiction the judges are enforcing because we are using colorable money. The government set up colorable law systems to fit the colorable currency. It used to be called the law merchant, or the law of redeemable instruments, because it dealt with paper that was redeemable in something of substance. But once Federal Reserve notes had become unredeemable, there had to be a system of law which was completely colorable from the start to the finish. And this system of law was codified as the Uniform Commercial Code and has been adopted in every state. One difference between common law and the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, is that in common law, contracts must be entered into knowingly, voluntarily, and intentionally. Under the UCC, this is not so. First of all, contracts they're not even necessary. Under the new law of agreements, they can be binding. And if you only exercise the benefits of an agreement, well, it's presumed or implied that you intend to meet the obligations associated with those benefits. If you accept a benefit offered by the government, then you're obligated to follow, to the letter, each and every statute involved with that benefit. And the trick has been to get everybody exercising benefits that they don't believe that they can live without. One benefit that I accepted was the privilege of discharging debt with limited liability instead of actually paying debt. And when I pay a debt, I give substance for substance. If I buy a quart of milk for silver dollar, that dollar bought the milk and the milk bought the dollar, substance for substance. But if I use a Federal Reserve note to buy the milk, I have not paid for it. There is no substance in the Federal Reserve note. It's a worthless piece of paper given in exchange for something of substantive value. Congress offers this benefit. Again, Congress offers this benefit. Debt money created by the federal United States can be spent all over the continental United States. It will be legal tender for all debts, public and private, and the limited liability is that I cannot be sued for not paying my debts. It's as if they said, well, we're going to help you out here, buddy. You can discharge your debts instead of paying your debts. When I use this colorable money to discharge my debts, I cannot use the common law court. I can only use the colorable court. And it would appear now that I'm stuck. If the only legal tender is colorable money, then if I use any legal tender, then the only court that is available to me is a colorable court. However, there is a way out. Volume 1, Section 207 of the Uniform Commercial Code states, quote, the making of a valid reservation of rights preserves whatever rights the person then possesses and prevents the loss of such rights by application of concepts of waiver or estoppel. This is UCC 1-207.7. It also says, quote, when a waiverable right or claim is involved, the failure to make a reservation thereof causes a loss of the right and bars its assertion at a later date. That's UCC 1-207.4. It also says the sufficiency of the reservation and any expression indicating an intention to reserve such rights is sufficient, such as without prejudice, UCC 1-207.4. Whenever I sign any legal papers that deal with Federal Reserve notes in any way, shape, or manner under my signature, I write or stamp without prejudice, UCC 1-207. And when I use without prejudice, UCC 1-207 in connection with my signature, I'm saying, quote, I have reserved my right not to be compelled to perform under any contract or commercial agreement that I do not enter knowingly, voluntarily, and intentionally. And furthermore, I do not accept the liability of the compelled benefit of any unrevealed contract or commercial agreement. Now, some people use a rubber stamp that says discharged without prejudice, UCC 1-207, on every Federal Reserve note that passes through their hand. I personally don't think that's necessary. In fact, I don't even go to this trouble. When I sign a contract above my signature, I write, all rights reserved, no rights waived, and then underneath that I write my signature, not below it. So what is a compelled performance of this unrevealed commercial instrument? When I use Federal Reserve notes instead of silver dollars, is this voluntary? No. There is no lawful money out there, so I have to use Federal Reserve notes. I have to accept the benefits. And the government has given me the benefit to discharge my debts with limited liability. Therefore, discharging my debts instead of paying my debts is a compelled benefit. The UCC says in Volume 1, Section 103.6, quote, the code is complementary to the common law, which remains in force except where displaced by the code. A statute should be construed in harmony with the common law unless there's a clear legislative intent to abrogate the common law. And it also says the code cannot be read to preclude a common law action. Now, most courts today are under colorable admiralty jurisdiction, also known as statutory jurisdiction. In admiralty jurisdiction, the technical niceties of the common law are not regarded. Quote, a jury does not figure ordinarily in the trial of an admiralty suit. The verdict of the jury is merely advisory and may be disregarded by the court. The rules of practice may be altered whenever found to be inconvenient or likely to embarrass the business of the court. A court of admiralty acts upon equitable principles. Have you ever heard a court case where the judge overrules the decision of the jury? This can only happen in a trial of admiralty jurisdiction. The jury is only the conscience of the court. The judge is not an impartial referee who understands public law, but rather is a commissioner that supports public policy, which is actually private law. And your attorney may not actually be working for you. In the volumes Corpus Juris Secundum, this is a complete restatement of the entirety of American law. In Volume 7, Section 4, it states, quote, an attorney occupies a dual position, which imposes dual obligations. His first duty is to the courts and the public, and not to the client. And wherever the duties to his client conflict with those he owes as an officer of the court in the administration of justice, the former must yield to the latter. Clients are also called wards of the court. Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition, states that a ward of a court is, quote, a person of unsound mind, end quote. So every time you hire an attorney, you have an unsound mind. So what does this mean? If you don't know how the legal system works, you'll be treated like a person of unsound mind that hires an expensive attorney who's an officer of the court to defend you, and that if the judge does not want to hear your arguments, well, he can command the attorney, without your knowledge, not to use the defenses. And the judge does not let the jury read the law. He only gives his interpretation of the law, and that the laws are usually part of very large bills that are never even read by members of the Congress who voted on them. And if that is in the unlikely event that the jury comes to the conclusion that the judge does not agree with, the judge can simply overturn the decision of the jury. Now, as bad as this is, it's not the worst case scenario. If you're accused of breaking certain administrative laws, well, such as a driving infraction, you do not have the right to even have this type of jury trial. In tax court, you're actually suing the IRS, which is presumed innocent until you prove that they are guilty. Because of this, you do not have the right to have counsel of your choice. Only the defendant has the right to counsel. The judges are the most successful former prosecutors in tax court. Is this the way our legal system was supposed to work? No. In common law, the jury determines both the facts and the law, and the judge is just simply an impartial referee, and the counsel of both the plaintiff and defendant are working for their clients. If you know how the legal system works and you are a state citizen, this is getting into now where I'm wanting to lead everybody to come to understand, you'll challenge the jurisdiction of the court and never go into anything but a common law court. Incidentally, if the flag in a courtroom has gold fringe on it, you are in an admiralty court. The jury can nullify a law. The two most notable times in the history of the United States were the end of slavery and the end of prohibition. Hiding escaped slaves was against federal law. Stolen property being transferred across state lines. People arrested for hiding runaway slaves, they would be tried. And in many cases, the jury would simply find the defendant not guilty because to them, the law was not a valid law. The same thing happened to bootleggers during Prohibition. If a prosecutor cannot get a jury to convict people of crimes, then the law has been effectively nullified. This is often referred to as jury nullification. And this was a way that the citizens of the freely associated compact states, the foundation of our government, they defended their sovereignty from the government. And if the government passed a law that the citizens disagreed with, well, they'd simply nullify it when someone was tried for breaking that law. This is the way the country was supposed to work. By trying cases in admiralty jurisdiction, the jury can still try to nullify a law, but the judge can overrule that decision made by the jury. In many cases, the judge incorrectly tells the jury they must follow the instructions to the jury. If a citizen cannot nullify laws, well, the federal government has more power. And then from the last few moments that of my sharing this with you, you may think that I do not have a high opinion of the integrity of our judges. This is not fully correct. The courts are there to resolve disputes without violence. Since the vast majority of the people in this country are either U.S. citizens or their residents, well, judges are correct to assume and presume that everyone that comes before them are under the exclusive jurisdiction of the Congress, i.e. federal citizens, i.e. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. It's up to the citizen to challenge the jurisdiction of any court. So if you're a state citizen and you take precautions for not making it easy for the federal government to make the presumptions that you're involved in an international contract, such as the Federal Reserve notes, then you will not be able to be charged with any statutory offenses, which is why I am pushing this button in coming into a working relationship with our new information provider. You will be able to do anything you wish, so long as you do not use force or fraud and you live with the consequences of your actions. In other words, your rights end where my nose begins. With that having been said, we'll cover next week on the prelude some more adhesion that comes with the federal glue that's all over most everything that we touch. Until then, let's turn this call over now to PJ and maybe use that as something for him to bounce off of. Go ahead, buddy.
Thank you. You hear me good here?
Perfectly clear. This is the clearest we've heard of you ever. So wonderful. No background noise, nothing.
Traveling, we didn't know how good the towers were.
No, you're great.
Yeah, U.S. courts, if anything, anytime you go into a court and there's a United States flag flying, that's a U.S. court. Anytime you see a United States flag flying on a boat, that's a jurisdiction of the United States. So it's pretty simple. Anyway, if the United States flag is flying, the Supremacy Clause is operating, and it's very important to understand that. A lot of the activity that U.S. courts partake in, they do not have jurisdiction. The activity did not occur and had any business to do with the United States, except them sticking their jurisdictional nose into something, which they like to. Mankind is status-minded, unless they're taught otherwise. They tend to, especially people that seek government positions, they believe that the state is the right way to go, and that the peasants need a sovereign to govern them, and they wish to be that sovereign, and they like to have the high pay that sovereigns get. And it usually leads to millions of dead babies like we have today with abortion. It's possible that abortions, various chemicals and pills and all this is killing up to one half to, you know, one fourth to one half of the children conceived in on American soil. And I think that's enough to make God extremely angry. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not murder. But as far as the, it was very interesting what Michael talked about, Federal Reserve participation. They probably will try to use that at times. For example, Michael talked about if you partake in a benefit, then you have to, they're going to assume that you're going to be complacent with all the terms of that service. So you have your house start on fire and fire truck shows up and you thank them and they're going to, and then you start challenging property taxes. They might very well use that. Well, you were happy about the fire department showing up. Now you're saying you don't want to pay property taxes. So we make it very important distinction when we take people off property tax rules, we send them down to the fire department immediately to inquire about their own personal fire protection service payment, independent of the any state or county or municipality process. And then that way, if your house does start on fire, the fire department will show up. Now, it's very likely that the fire department will be very reluctant to show up timely because they don't like your program of being off of the tax rules like that, because they consider it a threat. They consider it treason to Caesar. And that's the reality of what's going to happen. I had a house start on fire. It was a I bought a rental property for $13,000, I think, or $15,000, and I fixed it up, and it was worth about $75,000 or $85,000. And a fire started, and the four tenants that were there, four different apartments, they said the fire department just sat there and watched it burn. And then when we inquired about it,
They said that they were waiting for somebody to show up to unplug the electrical meter, which is baloney. All they had to do is walk over and unplug it. They got all kinds of tools to cut wires quickly and proceed with putting out the fire. But I believe it was intentional because they knew that I was in the process of challenging property taxes in their jurisdiction and or their claim jurisdiction, and they used that as an opportunity to burn me out. That's the price you pay for doing the right thing. Anyway, another situation an individual had is he was, I can't remember his, I think he worked for the city or something. Anyway, he got his property off the property tax rolls. He got his land and the property in that land off the tax rolls and moved them to the non-taxable rolls. Always remember that they're going to be on one roll, either the taxable roll or the non-taxable roll. Can't get them off the rolls completely, which is fine. But anyway, he got it off the tax rolls, and he didn't have any contract for fire. And the fire started, which was probably started by somebody in the government. That's what they do. They burn you out. I've had several fires start up. Almost positive that the government sent somebody in there to start a fire. It only takes a 2-cent stamp to burn a house down. One cent match. And anyway, the fire department showed up to this guy's house as it was burning, and the guy started out laying out all the hoses, and the police chief showed up and said, "Hey boys, this is not one of ours. Let it burn." So the guy lost his house. Anyway, and then I remember them. They pushed the issue, and he lost his job too with the city. Yeah, he had a city job, some kind of job, and he lost his job with the city. So, just as when the Christians didn't want to say Caesar is Lord, they were put to death summarily. The statism does it much the same thing, just in different ways. But it's evil, and it should be fought at every level. And I always tell people that if you don't have a reasonable chance of going to jail every year, you're probably not standing up for truth very much. Because in America, you have lots of opportunity to stand up for righteousness, proper conduct, proper government. And you'll face tremendous amounts of prosecution for that, and very likely you'll go to jail. Not for a long time, but they'll try to hammer you for exercising your right. It might be the right to travel. It might be the right to not to pay federal or state taxes. But they'll try to bring potential criminal actions against you. Now, as to this topic of the Federal Reserve Note participation, I think they'll probably try to do that in the federal courtroom. They'll say that you received Federal Reserve Notes and that you spent Federal Reserve Notes, and the judge would probably use that for the nexus to apply the jurisdictional subject to the federal courts. I just don't know. I do know that I had a case once where an individual came to me and he begged me to rent to him because nobody else would rent to him. So I rented to him, and then he begged me to help him with his books. So he says, "I'll sign the check over to you. And you can, now I found out later that this guy was setting me up. Anyway, so you can receive the government check and then you can give it to me so that I don't go down and blow it on drugs." Because he said he couldn't manage money. So I said, "Okay, boy, this is okay." So they'd give me the check of $550 a month, I think it was. And then, I would take out his rent for $350, and then some for $250. It was pretty low rent I was giving him. And a little bit for utilities. It probably ended up being about $350. The guy used a lot of electricity in the summertime, so it's probably $350, $450 in the summertime. But anyway, he did that for like 5 years. 3 to 5 years, I can't remember exactly. And then all of a sudden I get sued in federal court because I was renting him a house that didn't have storm windows on it, and the city municipal code condemned the house and tore it down immediately without even giving me an opportunity to have a day in court. It was just insane. Found out later they wanted the building because they bought the entire lot, the entire square block, and I was one of the only few buildings left. We're going to go into federal court on that under common law and see if they had a jurisdiction to do that, because my time is barred for statutory court as far as a 1983 action. Anyway, so they went to court, and the federal judge ruled against me for $80,000 and awarded him $80,000 because I was being Mr. Nice Guy. All because the house was missing storm windows. I bought this house, put a partially new roof on it, new siding. It's really a nice place. But the city wanted it because they're building a baseball stadium nearby. They wanted all new houses there. So they had to figure out a way to flatten that whole block. And I was in the way, so I got flattened with it. And end up costing me $80,000 too. Now, the guy never did collect on it, so I don't think he collected on any of it, but he might have got $20,000 out of my bank account once. I gotta try to figure out where that $20,000 went, if it went to that case or another case. So I had so much going on, and $20,000 was hard to keep track of some of that stuff. But anyway, just shows you how the Nexus got Nexus end, and they ended up using that as an excuse to apply the federal laws to me, basically saying that I couldn't charge rent for a house that was under state municipal code violations, which is absolutely insane. The nicest house on the block, just evil is what they did. Evil, evil, evil. I couldn't believe it that they would stoop so low. Now, the people that did that to me, I challenged them in various ways with briefs, and they all lost their jobs. So, and the prosecutors that came after me, they resigned from their jobs. So that's pretty interesting that they knew that something was coming that direction, and they bugged out of there. I think some of the guys that lost their jobs, they were told to continue such actions against me, and they refused to do it because they wouldn't answer the brief that I gave them. I was asking them if they had jurisdiction to do that, if they had, were in the Constitution, they had authority to steal this property from people like in this manner. And where did they get authority to tear a house down without the owner's permission? Things like that. And they can do that if it's in their land, but this wasn't evidence as in land of the United States, so they're completely out of their jurisdictional scope. Michael, if any questions pop up, go ahead and cut in, because sometimes I talk for an hour and I'm not for sure if I'm still connected with you guys. Still there, Michael?
Yes, sir. Start with pressing star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question. If you'd like to make a comment or ask a question to PJ, press star 2 on your keypad. For those of you listening on Freedoms Radio, you'll see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the center of the monitor. It's empty. Left-click inside of that silhouette and type away your comment or question. Outside the rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information, then hit submit, and I will read your comment or question on that side. So go ahead and continue, PJ, while we give them a chance to refresh.
Sure. So the a person would ask, you know, what's the big deal about letting government do this? What's wrong with letting the United States come in and have the land jurisdiction of all of the land between Mexico and Canada and the oceans? Well, for one thing, the founding fathers said that was a terrible thing to do, and they clearly structured the Constitution, the United States Constitution, to identify itself with specific land jurisdiction. And if they didn't do that, they knew that the government would grow larger and larger and larger, and the generations would pass away with the knowledge of small government. And before you know it, we'd have big government. And guess what has happened in 200 years? We've got big, big government. We have a government system now that has adopted to use the Federal Reserve System, which is not constitutional. And that's why they use the Federal Reserve System, because the government's not allowed to do that themselves. So they actually partnership with another company that does that. It's called the Federal Reserve System. It's not federal. It's not government. There's no reserves. There's no money. It's just fiat money. And they use it because they have easy credit without the people's permission. Now, if they want credit from me, if you come to me and you want credit at my grocery store, I would have to give you at least groceries, if not flat-out cash, for a loan or a credit. If it's credit, you know, you'd get groceries and you promise to pay me later. If it's just a flat-out loan, you'd want cash from me. So I would really notice that you're taking something from me, and I would be sitting back waiting for the day you're going to bring it back to me. And but with the government system, they can have truckloads, in a sense, electronically or physical, Federal Reserve dollars delivered to people or projects. And every time a semi-load, let's just hypothetically say there's no electronic transfers, it was all paper, $100 bills. A semi-load of $100 bills would be dumped into a neighborhood. That, if you know anything about economics at all, the more loads that are dumped there, the less the value of the $100 bill that is in your pocket becomes. It loses value. If there's one load dropped there, it loses a little value. If there's a million loads dumped there, it loses a tremendous amount of its value. And if you ever notice the house on the corner that used to sell for 1 year's wages, I'm just going to do an example, $10,000 house way back, you know, I'm talking back in the 50s. Yeah, you know, it sold for $10,000. Now that same house is worth $250,000 because of inflation. And if you were a good person that saved and you put money in the bank or in your basement or under your pillow or under your mattress, and then you pulled it out after 30 or 50 years of savings, you might be able to buy the same thing that it could have bought 50 years ago. So you didn't really gain much. And you might even lost. But that's what inflation does. It robs you of the ability to maintain value with currency laying around. Now, if you take out loans and you buy 10 houses for $10,000 each and you wait 50 years to pay them off, they've been dumping truckloads of money there, and it's easy to pay off the loans. And that's how the rich get richer. that's a one big way how the rich get richer. They get control of the house immediately early in their life, and they get to pay it off with cheap dollars at the end of their life. So they win on both ends. Where the studious person works hard all his life and pays for it at the end, he doesn't gain near as much as the person that takes advantage of the system. So that's what we got. It's a corrupt system. It's unbiblical. It's unequal weights and measures. And if you study economics, it's easy to see. A lot of people do not study economics, and they go, well, the government knows what they're doing. The Federal Reserve System's just fine. I'm doing quite well with it. We're doing better than any country in the world. Most people that say we're doing better than any country in the world hasn't traveled very much. There's a lot of countries that do really well if they stick really close to God's standards. Unfortunately, there's not very many that do. But the ones that do, they do very well. And when America started gaining wealth in the early 1900s, there was economic people, economists that were working for big government. And they were communicating to the government that the wealth had developed so great in America that you can forget about having any governance control over them, because they would not need anything from the government. They would not have no reason to develop any contracts with the government, because their wealth, the community wealth, would develop so great that there's no reason for them to turn to anybody, and they could live autonomously in that area. And if you live autonomous in an area, guess what? The government can't come in and charge you taxes, because there's no nexus there. It can't take part of your income every year, because there's no nexus. And that's what they feared. So they brought in the Great Depression, fiat money, Social Security, welfare, all that came in to start developing get their claws into the fabric of society, income, and the workforce. That's really what they want. They don't care much about your vote, and if you're going to vote Democrat or Republican, they'll put on this big clown show every so many months. Every couple of years, you'll get all this news, and you see all these signs along the road where people are, oh, wow, the power of the vote. Guess what? The vote those diabolical people want is your dollar, is your labor. They want to scrape off the cream of the crop every year right off the top of your labor. That's the vote they want to continue to maintain. They'll give the pretense of all the other activity of your control, and if that's really what they're maintaining, is to able to take part of your labor every year. So you got 95% of the people who are losing a substantial part of their income that are being taken by maybe the 5% of the remainder of the society. And it's extremely profitable to them. And you don't even know it. You just think it's all going to benefits and services, when the truth is, if they'd leave you alone, you'd have much better roads, much better homes, much better health care, much better education for your children, much better society. So come on, Michael, bring on the questions, okay?
Well, I'm asking for questions. So I've pressed star 2 on your keypad. Nobody has raised their hands. We're going to have an early call tonight. We have to stall this for another 5 minutes and say goodnight, unless someone has questions. Last week, you guys kept us here until 10:30, and that was great. Ah, here comes Miss Shelley. Very good. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, okay.
Yes.
My question is, I have been using the Without Prejudice 102.7.
102-7.
Right.
2-107.
2-107. Okay, and what is the point four mean again?
It's just the subsection within 107. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
No, what I was saying is that this thing that we've been talking about now for the last 2 weeks, or actually I've been talking about it for 3 weeks leading up to it, this thing about getting the State Department of the United States to issue you a card which, when processed by a terminal reader, whether it's in a squad car that pulled you up, pulled you over behind you, or it's anything, it's banking, going to a gun shop and bypassing all the stuff that they have to mess with, for a federal citizen, this is the key. I'm not the UCC 1-207 is not something that I do personally. I write above my name if there's anything, all rights reserved, no rights waived, and then I sign my name underneath that. Never do it in the reverse because it's nothing in law then. But go ahead, Shelly. You had a question attached to that.
No, that was basically it. Without prejudice.
I agree with Michael. I'd never encourage anybody to use UCC. If you use the UCC, you're implying that you have a contractual agreement with somebody to use the UCC. UCC is a contractual tool that's out there. If you wish to do business with certain banks, they tell you that this is one of our primary guidelines, the UCC. Now, when you do business with that bank, they give you full disclosure that the UCC is going to operate in that activity, govern most everything you do with the bank. But it's operating because you've elected to do business with that bank. If you don't have an election to do business with an entity that has adopted the UCC, why would you use it? It has no value if you use it unless the other party has agreed to use it also. Now, in the banking system, the bank's already agreed to use it. And then when you go to them to seek their services and benefits, you join their operation, which fully incorporates the UCC. So that's why it's operating there. But if you're doing business with somebody else and they write up a contract and you sign it and put UCC on it, if they're not disclosing to you the UCC is operating there, it has no value at all because they don't agree with it because it's not part of their business operation. So, but anyway, as far as this thing coming in where you have documentation from a government entity that you're not one of their persons or your car is not one of their fleets, your land is not of the United States, your property is not not registered with the state, things like that. I think it's an extremely valuable tool because remember I told you how the fire department showed up and they said, hey, boys, this is not one of ours. Let it burn. This is exactly what we're talking about. When they see a car go by and it's got plates on it, there's presumptive, there's a, what do they call that? That's evidence that it's one of their fleets. That's the evidence of one of theirs. Now, if a car goes by with a private plate on it, they still might pull it over and give you a hassle, but they don't have that prima facie evidence that it's of one of their fleets. Now, if you have a plate on it, it's only prima facie evidence that it's one of their fleets. You might have the plate on there just because you got tired of them bothering you when you didn't have a plate on it. But if you do just go grab a plate out and put it on there, it's you didn't steal it. You bought it from your neighbor for 10 cents and put it on your car. Or it's an old plate that you paid for and used years ago, and that's not making that car part of their fleet. There's a process that goes through to make it part of their fleet by giving them an MSO and maintaining that MSO relationship. But once a MSO title is given to the state, there is case law out there that once the owner that passed that MSO to the state sells that vehicle, that the state is no longer a holder of that property because it was only a contractual nexus based on the owner's desire for benefits and services. Anyway, but they hide that thing up. I haven't been able to find that case law for years. I'm still looking for it, but that is the premise of law. But they don't want, they're going to do everything they can to not agree with that. Now, this process here might be able to overcome that. Now, if you buy a brand new car and nobody's ever turned the MSO over to the state, then they don't have anything in their records of past or present ownership of that property. And it makes it way, way easier to travel anywhere in America without being harassed by them, which we have clients all over the nation that do. Usually it's the wealthy people that are able to buy a brand new car and pay cash for it and no MSO being passed any state entity is involved. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Now, as far as the other values, there's all kinds of nexuses the government tries to get into somebody. You got to get your kids down to public school. You got to get your kids down here to get vaccinations. You got to register your car. You got to pay property taxes. You got to register you bought this land. You got to get it down there and get a transfer statement into the state records, in the county records. You got municipal codes. You got to apply. You got to start following these or we're going to tear your house down. All kinds of nexuses, federal and state, city and county, municipalities, statism upon statism. And this process that Michael's talking about, if done properly, I think is a tremendous tool, because I do have friends that have been arrested that are excellent in law, and they're sitting in the back of the car as their name is popping up on the screen, and it says right on there, do not detain, do not arrest. And the cop will itch his head and go, and like, gosh, I've never seen anything like this before. I'm going to call this in, and the sergeant says, can't you read? Do not arrest, do not detain, unless you personally witnessed a felony. Let this guy go now. Now, if he witnessed a felony, if he watched you walk out in the street and shoot somebody in the chest with a gun, it wasn't self-defense, yeah, that's a felony. He doesn't have to get any agreement with any state statutes to arrest you. Neither do I. I can arrest you right there on the spot, and Michael could arrest me if I shot somebody and he witnessed it. Matter of fact, biblically, we're commanded to do that. We're commanded to stop such crimes. We're ordered to do it. If we don't do it, the Bible says we can be punished to the same degree that we failed to stop in society. But anyway, I'm kind of excited about it if it's done properly. I think, Michael's bringing in some heavy lifters, with knowledge of law into this, and I'm pretty excited about it. Okay, go ahead, somebody.
Well, let me just finish or add to what you're saying, PJ. This fellow has been doing
this
since, well, thank you so much, Michelle. I appreciate you. I thought he has been doing this since 2007. John, who has known him for this fellow for almost 30 years, says that he's been doing it more like for 25 years. Anyways, the point of it is this, is the fellow that's been doing this, this new information provider, he had only one focus. He was sick and tired of having to, you know, go to court, traffic issues, and that was it. So, you know, it was his research nearly 30 years ago that brought him to this place where all of his students, ever since this, he began to help other people with it and, you know, was working for him first, he began to sharing it and just word of mouth, that 100% of those that have gone through this process have received this card from the State Department of the United States. And when the law enforcement officer swipes that card through the reader, the computer's reader, magnetic strip, just like you have in, you know, anytime you make a purchase with your debit card or credit card, it just comes, like PJ said, says, do not detain, do not arrest, do not investigate, let go. And that's where this will take you. So when I heard this, this fellow's focus and limitations have been solely on traffic stuff. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. If you are truly, or as you are truly, a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states that came into existence under the Articles of Confederation, then any activity that you were involved with in the past is null and void in court. Why? Because if you're a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states, you were from the time of your birth. And they had the record wrong. That's why this is called correcting the record, correcting your status. So that when, hypothetically, you were arrested 20 years ago for whatever felony you were arrested for, maybe you know you had half a pound of cannabis in your car or something like that, whatever, and you went to prison for it, and you were released, and you're out. You've been out for a decade now. You can go back and open that case up, because you can claim jurisdictional challenges anytime. There is no statute of limitation on jurisdictional challenges. And once you do that,
wow,
they have to vacate the charges. And once that's been done, PJ and other people are going to say, hello, friend, would you like to go after some real nice candy and brass rings and have some fun? Because there is deprivation of rights under color of law. You have damages out the wazoo, whatever that means.
Mm.
So this has full application. Sure, go ahead.
I know the answer to this, but why don't they just put a statute of limitations on when you can challenge jurisdiction? It's because challenging jurisdiction is common law.
Yeah.
It's a right. You have a right to challenge authority. Okay? God doesn't really mind you challenge authority as long as you do it respectfully, even to him. You know, if you go to him with an honest heart and you challenge authority, he'll explain it to you, and you go, oh, well, that makes sense. I'm glad. Thank you for explaining that to me, Lord. But it's a common law principle. If a cop pulls you over, you have right to challenge his authority. Now, when he pulled you over, he could have pulled you over for a common law reason. He's seen you shoot somebody in the chest with a gun. And that's a felony. He doesn't need to go look in the statute books to figure out something's how to charge you. He can just say it's murder or attempted murder. And he can throw it in front of a jury. He doesn't have to go to a U.S. court. He can go straight to common law and push it through. Now, cops don't know this, so they run to the statutory courts. But anyway, now, if it's not a felony, if you crossed over the yellow line driving your car, see, then that's not a common law principle, generally. If you cross over it really bad, you know, it's a common law principle because you put somebody in danger on the other side. But your tire just touched it, and their law says, oh, if you touch it, you you know, it's a statute violation. So what you can do is you challenge that guy, you know, what did I say, do or sign as a man that written law that you're bringing forward is that you have authority to apply it to me? Another question, activity that I did, you know, I drove my car 1 inch on the yellow line. Where in the written law does it say that which written law did I violate? So they have to bring that forward. Then the third one is, okay, let's just say that I did drive on the line and that you do have a law that says that you can't drive on that line. And, okay, so what evidence do you have that that written law applies in that location of land? So we got jurisdiction of the person, of the activity, and the territorial jurisdiction. So there's three common law principles that you can bring forward as a right and challenge. And sometimes they'll be able to prove all three. And if they do, guess what? You're subject to the U.S. court. Now, if they can't produce the evidence to support all three jurisdictions, it cannot be, the court cannot declare jurisdiction, and the administrator must dismiss. And if he doesn't dismiss, then you can sue that administrator for misapplying United States written law. And you can go for damages in a common law court. If they don't want to give you damages in their court, satisfies you, you can go into a common law court. So, okay.
All law that exists is divided in two broad general categories. One category is described as malum prohibita, and the other is malum in se. Malum in prohibita is simply, you can't do that because we said you can't do that. That's all malum prohibita is. Some governing body says you can't do it because we say so. Malum in se is the Almighty One saying, you can't do this. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Blah, blah, blah. Those are malum in se laws. And those are the common law that we all operate under. What this process does in you correcting the record is it removes all of the malum prohibita laws that can be applied against you. Simple as that. So doing 100 miles an hour down the speedway, down the interstate, is not illegal. You haven't caused an accident. You haven't hurt anybody. Nobody's run off the road. And the cause of action would be in an accident of them against you, not the state against you. They're the injured party. They're the ones that have to bring the lawsuit. So it's. I am so excited. I'm so stoked about this, as we used to say back in the day, that we've got a tool now that changes everything. We have many, Bernie, PJ, has many students that absolutely must have this process, must have the end up with this correcting status. And it comes from the State Department of the United States. It's not something that you make up. It's not making up something. It comes from the very government that's been oppressing you. Leave this one alone. He's not one of ours. So thank you all for joining.
If you're a diplomat and you come in from another country, they give you kind of like documents like that, you can pretty much walk away from most situations that the state brings after you, except for flat-out felonies. Not the same, but it's kind of like that. So, okay, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, Tom. Go ahead, Tom. He just pressed star two. Glad you did.
Yeah, hey, good evening, gentlemen. How are we doing?
Great.
Great, great. Appreciate the information here. Who's the administrator when you're talking about this? Who's the administrator? Does that mean
the
you said we can go
provider?
After the... Huh?
No, go ahead. Sit, repeat your question. I misunderstood. Repeat your question.
Oh, okay, you just said a few minutes ago that we can go after damages for the administrator when we get the record corrected or whatever. Who's the administrator?
Right. Anyone that was involved in your arrest, anyone involved with your arrest, the court proceedings, anybody that's involved, depriving
you
of your rights.
Wow.
Here's an example. We have a conspiracy. We have a case going right now. They conspired against an individual's rights. The court clerk expired. The prosecutor violated his rights. The judge violated his rights. Can you think of any other, Michael? I named off three there.
The arresting officer.
The U.S. Marshal.
Possibly the U.S. Marshal will go after. But anyway, anybody that knew they were doing wrong or should have known they were doing wrong is subject. Everything the United States does is in an administrative capacity.
Right.
Nobody is doing it judicially. It's all administrative. The legislature, the people and the legislature make the law. Okay, and then they administrate it. They do not make law at all. They can only administrate it.
Right.
And if they color outside of the lines, it's called color of law, and they're not allowed to do it.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I was excited. It's kind of that's good. Appreciate it. We'll stay in touch with that, and we'll talk sometime about the Federal Reserve and things. I have a few avenues on that too, and because I'm finding out that a lot of these bankers realize, and they don't want to talk about it, but they realize the fraud and the conspiracy that they're promoting upon the public and their customers at the bank by the false misrepresentation of the Federal Reserve.
That's true, because if you study the Federal Reserve System, it's only to be applied for military necessity. What the hell are you guys applying to people wanting to buy a new car for or a new house?
Right, right. And these bankers have been doing it, and that's just, yeah. So, well, I think this has come, but, yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. So, all right, thanks, gentlemen. We'll talk in a few days here. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. Most importantly, of course, thanking PJ. Next week, return, and we're going to be covering this federal glue, more federal glue that adheres us to these contracts and agreements, that puts us under their thumb, and how we lose our rights in the process. So join us next week, and thank you again, PJ. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.